This is Keeping It 101, a Killjoy's Introduction to Religion podcast.
What's up, nerds?
Hi, hello. I'm Elise Morgenstein First, a scholar of religion, history, and Islam, raiser of Killjoys, raiser of patriarchies, and raiser of goblets of rosé because it's summer.
Yay. Hi, hello. I'm Megan Goodwin, a scholar of gender, sex, sexuality, and American religions, a public scholarship maven, and a fan of a bubbly drink or two.
It's smart girl summer. We're riffing on the feminist, woman-led bands and punk movements of the 70s, 80s, and 90s. We were thinking Bikini Kill, Heralds of the Riot Girls, of course. But instead, where scholarship and podcasting is a place of resistance and sustenance and politics and community. And good news, nerds, today's no different. We have a final riotous treat of the summer for you. Today's installment, what might popular culture tell us about religion, and how does popular culture influence religion?
Ooh, tasty. I'm excited. Slather on the sunblock. It's time for the lesson plan.
Slather is such a gross word. I'm sorry.
It really is. It's fine.
Today, we're talking pop culture. Not just because it's fun, like we did in the extracurricular RuPaul episode back in season one, but because the so-called lowbrow, popular, and consumable media influences religion, has religion in it, and helps us think about religion IRL. That's in real life. And good news, nerds, this quarter of culture is Megan's forte.
In the immortal words of that eminent thinker, Oscar the Grouch, I love it because it's trash. It's funny because it's true. So what we're doing today is talking about why we care about pop culture. And spoilers, this will shock you, but we care a lot. Sometimes pop culture is a barometer for how a community feels, thinks, or acts. Sometimes pop culture moves how communities think, feel, and act. And always, always, pop culture reflects the values of the communities it comes from. The media, art, literature, noise we make and consume tells us a heck of a lot and makes and remakes a lot of the world we live in. Popular culture, again, spoilers, is never apolitical, nor is it innocuous. So our thesis today, what we're trying to walk you through in between reapplications of sunblock, I'm so pale, anyway, is that if we care about religion, we care about how religion is portrayed popularly. What kind of art, what kind of trash do people make when they're trying to think through what religion is and what it does?
Keeping It 101 on today, the segment where we do some professor work. Okay, so to get at popular culture and its myriad tangible effects, we're going to look at a specific case study, the book and later film, Not Without My Daughter by Betty Mahmoudi. But before we get there, I want to set up some basics. And the reason we're jumping right in, folks, is because this is really Megan's forte. So if we don't have a tight leash on things, this could be a 7-hour episode.
Challenge accepted.
Okay, so before we get to this really rad case study that is going to, I'm already, like, I have, like, pre-hives just thinking about it. Megan, how would you define today's keyword, popular culture? And then secondarily, I kind of want to know how popular culture is related to, like, regular culture?
Oh, I know this one.
It's our secret word of the day.
Pop culture, popular culture, refers to what regular folks might enjoy as opposed to like snobby professor types. Although you already know this about us, dear nerds. Some of us professors also enjoy this nonsense. So opera is high culture in this model, but like TV or certain shows on TV, like reality television, for example, like drag shows, for example, is not high culture. And duh, as you can probably guess, I care about this division specifically because it tells us something about who gets to decide what counts as culture and what is dismissible as pop. For real, do you think opera is defined as culture by, say, lots of poor, queer, Black women? Hard no. Wealthy, white, cis, hetero, American, and European folks called that shit culture. And then they did a ton of work to keep it from non-white, non-wealthy, non-hetero, non-Americans, and Europeans. And then told everybody else they were stupid and uncultured for not liking or understanding opera. And opera is just one obvious example. Pause for confession. I am a classically trained first soprano back in the day, so this example is close to my heart. Opera is a popular example of what rich, educated white folks might like. to even get into it, you might need education in Italian. My Italian sucks. So for me, pop culture is a framework that helps us get into how communities make, write, sing, perform, paint about their world, and how those worlds are remade by those writings, those songs, those performances, those paintings. Do people consume it? Do they take it in? Does it have influence on how we think and feel and perceive the world? Then it's culture and it's worth studying. Pop culture helps me think about things that others, be they fellow scholars or educated elites, or just snobs, might dismiss in some way, like, oh, that's not a real thing to study, or this is just guilty pleasure. Or memorably, as some troll said on LiveJournal during my first year in grad school, that it was gutter scholarship. True story. So please don't miss the race and gender notes here, friends. Literally, my work starts with stuff your mom's book club reads and why we think we can just blow that stuff off, as though it doesn't help shape the way that people think and move in the world. Calling something pop culture is a way to devalue and dismiss it. I'm trying to show how much the stuff we're taught to dismiss matters. And spoilers, again, it is a serious lot.
Yeah, and I have to say, Megan, that's actually one of the things I've really learned from you in our long marriage of sharing ideas. And that's that I can't underestimate how much TV and books, and in the example below, this category of pulp nonfiction has not just like rewired my own brain and experience of the world, but rewired American brains, politics, and policy.
Oh, yeah.
And since I'm going to make you talk about the genre of writing, because, dear nerds, Megan has a book about this coming out just a few days before this podcast will drop.
Do I?
So this case study is ripped from her book, and I think she is the expert, literally, to help us walk through this kind of scholarship. And since I'm going to make you talk about it, I want you to first define some of the things we're working on. So that was pop culture. Can you remind me, since Not Without My Daughter fits into this category of pulp nonfiction, can you tell everybody what pulp is? Since when I hear that phrase, I'm decidedly thinking Royale with cheese.
Fair enough. And hey, thanks, girl. It's nice to hear that, you know, I like help you think about things. I cherish you. Okay, so I have studied pulp nonfiction, and that is a phrase that I'm borrowing, who's an Iranian studies scholar. She works on Iran and Islam and gender and does a lot of work on these kind of books as they pertain to Iranian ladies. So I've been studying this kind of pulp nonfiction for the better part of the last decade now as a way to think about white supremacy and gender and sex abuse. We're going to talk about more of that later. Pulp.
It's our secret word of the day.
Which can be fiction, Royale with cheese, or nonfiction, is usually work that folks consider sort of tasteless, garish, over-the-top, poor quality, sensationalist, basically catering to our baser instincts, guilty pleasures, if you will. So unlike other forms of popular media, like film or TV, it's super extra easy to dismiss this kind of media because it has a reputation of being over-the-top garbage trash. And honestly, it's not over-the-top, and in many cases, racist garbage. It's just that the over-the-top, often racist garbage is sometimes the only thing people read, say, about American minority religions. That's a word that's in the title of my book, which is called Abusing Religion, Literary Persecution, Sex Scandals, and American Minority Religions. And I just want to offer a definition of that as well, because I got started in religious studies looking at new religious movements, but I quickly became aware that the way we marginalize quote-unquote new religions looks an awful lot like the way we marginalize other non-white, non-Christian, non-Protestant-looking until the 1980s religions. So the way that we make fun of, dismiss, code as dangerous religions like, say, Church of Scientology, has a lot in common with the way that we marginalize and code as dangerous religions like Islam, for example.
Mm-hmm. I was nodding out loud. I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, that's it. Yeah, did nod out loud, given that it is an audio medium. And Vicky tells me that I have to listen to things more closely.
That's true. Okay, now that I know what pulp is, or I have a refresher, let me set up our primary case study today. The pulp nonfiction classic, which like grosses me out so much that this is a classic.
I hate it.
The pulp nonfiction classic, Not Without My Daughter. And I am specifically, this is addressed to you, Megan, not even you nerds. I'm specifically not letting you set it up because like you dive in as if we have all done a decade's worth of work on this book and on the movie and have like written multiple things about it. So I'm going to take us through the basics. And if I F it up, you just interject and tell me. Okay.
Okay. Fine. Yes. Fine. Yes. Good. Thank you for being what feels like a lifelong reader and checker of my work. And also thank you for not letting me rage vomit case studies on our pod.
Always. Okay. So Not Without My Daughter is an autobiographical book by Betty Mahmoudi with William Hoffer about her escape. And I'm not sure if I want to say alleged escape or escape.
She got out. Sure. Like, we'll grant her that. Yes. She left Iran under contentious circumstances.
Fair. Okay. From Iran, her abusive husband and like with her daughter in 1986.
Yes, she did not leave without her daughter.
That's the title. The book comes out a year later in 1987. And then 4 years after that, in 1991, it's made into a movie starring famously, I think, Sally Field. Both the book and the movie were enormous hits, even though the movie took some critical bashing. They were economic, and there was some critical success, especially for the book, which was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. Yeah. Okay. And so the outline of the story is, dear nerds, if you don't know it, is something like this. Betty lives with her husband, who's a doctor in the U.S. named Syed Bazoug Mahmoudi, whose nickname is Moody.
Yep.
And they have a daughter. Moody experiences racism in the first part of this book because they're living in the U.S. and he's Iranian. And remember, of course, that the early and mid-80s were right around the time of the 1979 revolution in Iran and the hostage crisis of 79 and 80. So,
Pause. You have to tell the listeners because lots of them don't know that because lots of them are Americans who are younger than us. So after the 1979 revolution / if you haven't seen Argo, a number of Americans who had been working at the embassy were held hostage by Iran because the U.S. had played a key role in overturning a democratically elected leader of Iran and reinstating the Shah, who propped up British and U.S. oil interests. Basically, we fucked their government all up, and Iranians were real mad about it, and they took some hostages about it, and it was on the news every night for over a year.
Yeah, and not just like, we didn't just like prop up their scary colonial economic systems. We also enabled and in fact taught the Shah's army the CIA tactics of torture.
Yeah.
So like, this is not a small deal. And I'm sorry, dear nerds, that I did not go into a full thing about it. We can recommend more books and articles about the revolution and the hostage crisis if you want. But right now I'm sticking with the story.
Stick with the story, but like, I also have to name that out loud because I got to be honest, until I started looking at this book, I didn't know that much about the 1979 Iranian Revolution. Like, I knew it happened. Kind of. The end. Americans don't know their history.
I know.
We suck. Moving on. Okay. And we read these shitty books that teach us the... Anyway, we'll get there.
Okay. I'm sorry. Sometimes my Islamic studies, where I have to know the whole globe and most of its history, gets in the way of understanding what Americans do and do not actually know.
We don't know so much, and we don't even know how much we don't know.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Back to Not Without My Daughter. He's experiencing racism in the U.S. because there's a huge groundswell of anti-Iranian and anti-Muslim sentiment after the 1979 revolution and hostage crisis. And then our sympathy in the book shifts. So at the beginning of the book, we're like, oh man, that really sucks. We feel for this guy. They go on what Betty thinks is going to be a vacation to Iran, and immediately everything changes. The second they get there, more or less, Moody, her husband, shows his true colors, and those are that he's an abusive, fanatical monster of a man. Mm-hmm. He bars them from leaving Iran, taking her passport, leaving her without money and transportation. In this atmosphere, and there's like all sorts of scary violence in the middle of this too, like truly like physical and sexual abuse. Fearing for her daughter's life and her own, Betty Mahmoudi escapes. I want to say before we get into the rest of it that Moody, her husband, refuted this story. And so it's a little bit more complicated than what Not Without My Daughter lays out. But in any case, we care about this pulp nonfiction because, well, everything that happens in this story is like a foul, horrific, racist depiction of Iranians specifically and Muslims and Islam broadly. And everyone's mom's book club read this book. Megan?
They're still reading it. They're still reading it.
Oh, boy.
Is the thing.
How'd I do? What'd I miss?
Oh, good. No, okay, okay, okay. Without diving into, A, how easy it is to get nominated for Pulitzer and all that shit, I think the one thing that I want to add is how all of this media builds on itself, because it's not just that this book comes out, right? It's that it becomes a movie. It's building on all of this news coverage. Again, this is a time where there are like three channels and all of them every night are covering the Iranian hostage crisis for over a year. Plus, the translation of the book, which confirms many racist Americans' absolute worst imaginations of Muslims and Muslim men specifically, gets compounded by the fact that Sally Field gets cast in the film. Because before Sally Field was like Forrest Gump's mom, or I think she's in The Help, right? If you did not live through the 80s, I don't know that you have a full grasp of how beloved Sally Field was. So she's not any white lady. She's every white lady. She's Gidget. She's the Flying Nun. She is literally America's sweetheart at this point. So to watch her get the shit kicked out of her by this violent Muslim man who is violent, not just in his own marriage, but it's like indicative of how Muslim men really are, even though they try to trick us and make us think that they're just like us. That picturing of Sally Field as every white American lady and how endangered she is by Muslim men becomes this moment of trying to convince all white American ladies that they are in danger of being abused by Islam and Muslim men, and how dangerous Islam is to America. It's a whole big thing.
Yeah. So what I hear you saying around like how both this particular book and movie's reception worked, but maybe pop culture more broadly, especially when it's like a multimedia pop culture, is that these things become mutually reinforcing and mm-hmm. they become juggernauts in their own right, right? Like mm-hmm. like the news feeds into why the book was popular. The book gets sold as movie rights. A beloved actress plays the main character. So the book is re-released with a picture of the movie on the cover. So the book sells more. So there's more interest in the movie. So the movie gets sold on budding and new cable networks at night, like HBO, right? Like, so all of those things.
The movie gets released the week we go into Iraq, right?
Yeah, 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 yeah. So like there's so many things that keep compounding and compounding. So it's not just like this book came out in 1987 and then after that it's like you like hand down a copy from your mom to someone else. It's like on many, many reprints with many, many different covers that virtue signal what's going on in the country at the time.
Yep. Yes.
Now that we've set that up a little bit, can you, Goodwin, tell me and our nerdy listeners why we should care about this old ass book and its like Razzie nominated film companion?
Oh, there are so many reasons that you have to care about this terrible book. I care about it. And now you're going to care about it. And let me tell you why. Okay. We're going to give you links in the show notes. So I'm really going to try to broad strokes this. But major reasons I want our nerdy listeners to care a lot about the stupid book and its stupid movie are as follows. So one, this book isn't happening in a vacuum, right? America loves to tell itself stories about what happens if we don't protect white women in the right way and the kind of danger that they're immediately in. So this isn't just a story about Islam and Muslim men as a specific threat to white ladies in America. It's a broader way of telling ourselves stories about why we have to be really scared of people who are different from us, and particularly be really scared of religions and religious people who are different from us. And then when we get to Not Without My Daughter specifically, it's a really compelling story about, like, one woman's experience of surviving domestic violence against all the odds. And it draws us in as feminists, as freedom-loving Americans. That shit is really consumable, right? Like, there's a reason that people love stories like this so much. It reaffirms this narrative of, like, resistance in the face of tyranny. But that's the surface, right? Lurking beneath this book, and, like, not very far beneath this book in this movie, are some violent, scary, long-lasting American biases against Muslims and Islam. Betty Mahmoudi portrayed her husband and his family, all Iranians, and basically all Muslims, as dirty, dangerous, animalistic, violent, and especially abusive of, quote, their, unquote, women. Mahmoudi literally says her husband is abusive and violent because he's Muslim, because he's Iranian. So all Muslims and Iranians must be fundamentally un-American and violent, especially toward women. That really matters. It also matters because, like, this pulp nonfiction is still in print. It's cheap. Its cover has been updated to highlight our current image of scary Muslims. So, like, it, of course, has a woman in, like, full niqab. It's popular. It's everywhere. And for a lot of folks, it is the only thing. I can't stress this enough. It is the only thing they will ever read about Islam or about Iran. Like, this is what your mom knows about Islam, for real. Sorry about it, but it's true. Not your mom, at least, because she knows you. But, like, everybody else's mom. This is all my mom knows about Islam. Yeah, I hate it. Okay. So, like, one of the side points in the book and the movie is that before Moody steals Betty away to Iran under false pretenses, he acts like a regular, secular, Iran-hating American, but then he isn't. She uses the language of reversion and, like, backsliding a lot. So the message of this book is, like, even supposedly good Muslims, even supposedly good Iranians, even supposedly good immigrants can't really be trusted because their true natures will eventually betray them and, more importantly, will betray, attack, violate white American women, America.
Ugh. That's so gross.
Yes.
And I hate it so much.
Yes, you should. You should hate it. It's disgusting. I hate it. Let's all hate it together. Yeah. So, there are many reasons I want you to care about this book and its movie, like how Oprah's own network plays it all the time, still, in the year 2020. How it shows up as a feminist book on actual bookshelves. It's actually in an encyclopedia of feminist literature. How people have used it as evidence in actual courts to prove Muslims and Iranian men are inherently violent and should not be trusted with their own children. But I know you're waiting for me to tell the story about Betty Mahmoudi and how she became a literal politician and an advisor. I am not shitting you to the United States government.
It's true. I know. Dear nerds, I write these scripts and I am like literally waiting on bated breath for Megan to tell the part of the story that I've already myself written because it is like, hold on to your butts. It's bananas.
Grasp your butts.
Okay, keep going.
Seriously.
Keep going. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. I think this is the part where you were reading my draft and you're like, wait, what? It broke
my brain.
Okay, so this trash book, this garbage fire book, and the movie, obviously, because we can't discount Sally Field, Gidget, Flying Nun. This story...
Norma Rae.
Yeah, oh god, yeah. Woof. Mm-hmm. So American. This story, this garbage fire of a story, literally helped shape U.S. federal law and policy. In 1993, President Bill Clinton signed the International Parental Kidnapping Crime Act, which makes the international abduction of a child by a parent a federal felony offense. I am not exaggerating when I say that Mahmoudi, and Not Without My Daughter, made this law happen. She was the only person to be named in the Senate hearings for the House Resolution, that's 3378 for you law nerds, the bill which eventually became the International Parental Kidnapping Crime Act. Senators mentioned the book in deliberations, and if that's not enough, later, the whole ass U.S. State Department appointed Mahmoudi as an advisor, quote, on the plight of American women and children held against their will in foreign countries, end quote.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
This garbage matters. I know this. This garbage matters.
I know this because I've read your article, which about this, and now and your now out book like countless times. But I need to say this because like, quite honestly, nerds, and this is not just like, I'm not play acting here. Every fucking time I revisit your work on this, I am floored that this pulp nonfiction, this autobiographical memoir, literally reshapes policy in the US. And like, and at the same time, like, Not Without My Daughter was contested. There are challenges to the veracity of this book and her story. And even Roger Ebert in his review of the movie, for realsies, was like, guys, this is real racist. So in its moment, this was not wholesale by every reader everywhere accepted as immutable truth. And yet, this book's and the movie's pulp popularity made it possible for Mahmoudi, a random lady and survivor, it made her a lawmaker and advisor to the U.S. State Department. Her book is the literal basis of international policy.
Yeah, is this a good time to tell you that memoirs aren't fact-checked? So,
I mean, I knew that, but yes, that's a good time to tell our audience.
Yeah, they're not.
It might explain steam coming out of my headphones.
Not fact-checked, absolutely contested. Scholars, policy, like, no one who consumed this media with a critical eye thought it was a gospel joke, question mark. Like, this was never, like, something that just got released and everybody went, oh, yeah, okay. It was always contested. And yet, as you point out, Elise, President William Jefferson Clinton helped turn her book into international law. It is correct. Do you need a minute?
And so fast, too. Like, dear listeners, I want you to hear the timeline. She gets out of Iran in 86. The book comes out in 87. The film is released in 91. Yep. The law is 93. Yep. So, like, this is a phenomena.
Yep.
And I'm broken.
It's a juggernaut.
I'm like, I know this stuff and I want to, like, I'm sweating. I'm sweating with rage.
Yeah, you should be. You should be rage sweaty. Do you need a minute? You are having a very violent reaction to facts.
I mean, that's kind of our brand is like violent reaction to facts, but I do need a minute. So can you bring us back while I, like, you know, get a handkerchief or something? I am stuck on trashy pulp nonfiction author makes more of a difference than I ever will in the world while she's also in an adjacent field to my own expertise. Like, I'm stuck in that. So can you help me bring it back to the thesis? I know that was in theory my job. How does Not Without My Daughter help us see pop culture and religion as intertwined or working on each other or doing work in the world?
I am so glad that you asked me that because I think it's really important. Super big story is that, man, you can never discount the political power of a good story. Omid, actually, our previous guest star, talks about this all the time, where good stories change the world. This pulp garbage, trash fire of a story, it has legs. And I want to pause and acknowledge that this story is important to a lot of people, and particularly a lot of survivors of domestic and sexual assault, because she survived. She gets out, right? And too many people do not survive domestic assault or domestic violence. Too many people do not survive sexual assault. So her story matters as an example of violence, of intimate partner violence, being survivable. And I get that. That's one of the things that's complicated here and about all my case studies, honestly. At the same time, though, it is unfortunate, but also true, that her inspiring story of surviving domestic violence is also racist as fuck. It gets accepted into a cultural mainstream, white American culture, in part because it reflects what Americans already assumed about Iran and Muslims, and especially Muslim men in 1987. Muslim men, according to this story and stories like it, were irredeemably violent, utterly backward and barbaric, because they beat women. That's how you know, right? and fundamentally unable to be otherwise. Even when Moody is good at the beginning of the book, we later learn that it was all an act, or like maybe he had even convinced himself, but she, Betty, clearly knew or should have known better, because this is what Muslim men are. So that's her story, right? But like, also this book and this movie tell a story that America already believes. It bolsters racialization of Iranian Muslims. It becomes the catalyst for laws and also civil suits against Muslim men, particularly around custody. Betty Mahmoudi becomes an honored spokesperson for domestic violence. Her story of escape contributes to the idea that all women, and especially potentially including Muslim women, need saving from Muslim men. And we need to shout out, obviously, Abu Lugod's very famous article and then book, Do Muslim Women Need Saving? Now, stories like the one Betty Mahmoudi told have helped justify sustained aggression toward Muslims, American or otherwise, by portraying Islam as inherently foreign and essentially violent toward women. Not Without My Daughter is both a popular reflection of American norms, and it further solidifies and even codifies those norms. So here, pop culture's influence on our ideas about religion, specifically Islam here, and religious people, Muslims and good white Christian women alike, it's so obvious once you go looking for it. But if you dismiss pop culture as unimportant, then you don't have to ask if it's also contributing to like racialization of Muslims, white supremacy, militarization and imperialism, and military incursion against, say, Muslim majority countries. I'm like, fucking Oprah, man, Oprah, who is in a lot of ways the voice of American women, supported this work at the height of her Oprah-ness. Her network is still airing this garbage movie on the reg. And I think Not Without My Daughter really helps us think harder about how whiteness works. Why was this book so popular? Why was it so readily accepted? Why did even frickin' Oprah, who is famously, very famously not a white lady, fall victim to this troubling story of a woman who was lured or tricked into an abusive relationship? So I've argued that Not Without My Daughter does all of this work precisely because Betty Mahmoudi portrays herself and then is portrayed by Sally Field as an unwitting, trusting, loving white woman, a symbol of purity in a white supremacist system. We're used to these stories. They're not new. They always, always do damage. And white women have a long, long history of deploying this very narrative for their own benefit, as we recently saw, say, in a video about a white lady who couldn't just let a black man look at some damn birds in Central Park. The story of white women under attack, also being the story of America and Americanness being attacked, is a really, really old one. It is arguably just about as old as American cinema itself. This is all very Birth of a Nation. Pause to shout out Judith Weisenfeld and her thinking on that horrible, tenacious film. So yeah. Not Without My Daughter is a late 80s, early 90s phenomenon that draws on notions of white women being victims and captives of hostile, militaristic, nationalized, masculinized religious fanaticism, and specifically Islamic religious fanaticism. We need to think about these popular stories because they're popular, because they're influential, because they're accepted as just common sense. And they do real violence in the world, beyond just helping us see how notions of religion and religious people play out in supposedly secular, trashy places like these truly, truly terrible books you buy in airports.
Yeah. Thanks, Megan. I think that case study really, I just think it like nails it. I really do.
You're welcome. Happy summer, okay. Everybody.
Yeah, you sound sad and tired. So since we've heard from Megan and her super rad book, let's hear about us. It's primary sources.
Primary sources. Okay, my primary source from today comes from being a wee graduate student at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and standing in the hallway being introduced to the department's major donor. Now, it's unusual, honestly, for departments, particularly for state school departments, to have donors, but UNC did. Does? Question mark. I don't know. I don't bother anymore. And I met this very nice, very well-intentioned white lady who likes me, actually invited me to her wedding. True story.
Wait, what?
Oh, no.
I'm sorry. Flag on the field.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Your life is so weird.
I know. That is,
okay, I'm sorry. I'm
stuff sorry. Does, like, but this is like, that's where we're at, right? I mean, it was a big wedding, but still. So I'm being introduced to her and we're chatting and she's asking me about my research and I have just started kind of noodling through this. And because I was in the middle of writing the chapter about Not Without My Daughter, I said, okay, well, the thing that I'm writing now is about how these stories about Muslim men attacking and hurting and controlling white American women get so popular. And her response, and I will quote it word for word for you listeners, was, quote, well, isn't that true?
Ugh.
Yeah. So, like, A, that's a gross question. B, ew. C, if you have spent any time with me in person, you know that I have no poker face at all. And so I am...
What?
It's true, at least sometimes I do a bad job of keeping how I'm thinking and feeling off my face, which turns bright red when I'm angry. So I have been introduced to this major donor by my advisor slash the dude who gets to decide whether I get a PhD or not, and who is also obviously trying to get this lady to continue to give us more money. And I'm watching him watch me try not to explode. So in possibly the greatest act of self-restraint I have ever exhibited in my entire life, I managed to say only, I think it's really interesting that you think that.
And, oh, no.
And then for some reason, this major donor was spirited away very quickly from my presence. The end.
I could not imagine
that. No, I don't know why.
Were you guys just like in the hall?
Yeah, no, we were in front of the main office.
Oh, no, I know exactly where that happened. That is Awkward City. Isn't that true?
Well, isn't that true?
I want to like retroactively unleash your Kraken on that lady.
But like, and the thing was, is it's not, she didn't ask it in a mean or like a bitchy way, just in like a, no, oh, we're having a like chill conversation. Isn't that true?
Right. Right. Well, like that's the perniciousness of white ladies and their white supremacy.
Accurate. Anyway, so that's my primary sources.
Well,
your turn.
I guess I'll make mine about Not Without My Daughter too, because why not, dear nerds? But like, as a scholar of Islam, let me say out loud, I have never read this trash book. I have never watched this trash movie. I only know about it through Megan.
Remember when Cody refused to watch this movie for me? I was like, I need to know things about Iran. She's like, no, fucking read something. I'm not watching this.
Anyway. Well, like, Kathleen M. Foodie is a serious scholar of Iran. Like, this is not our thing. Anyway, so I do a lot of public lectures about Islam, like, honestly, so many. And I could talk more about why I do those lectures. But frankly, as a white woman, I find it is actually part of my job as a PhD holder in Islamic studies to talk to hostile and semi-hostile audiences about Islam, so that, quite honestly, Muslims do not have to do that work.
Yeah.
Anyway, even in the lovely so-called liberal state of Vermont, there's never, literally never, been a talk where someone, usually a woman of a certain age, doesn't come and either ask me about Not Without My Daughter or tells me how much she loved that story or wants me to disprove its core narrative, right? Like similarly to the Isn't That True? Or asks me how I could possibly talk about domestic violence, how I could leave out domestic violence from my like intro 101, What Are Muslims talk, when clearly domestic violence plagues Muslim communities because of this book. So as you've so frequently said, and I've like straight up lifted this from you, Megan, my go-to line is like, yeah, of course, domestic violence happens because sexual and domestic abuse happens, but it doesn't happen because of Islam or because of Iran, regardless of you reading this trash book, comma, white ladies of a certain age. But I can't escape this dumbass book and this dumbass movie, even in a so-called liberal place like Vermont, which I think shows me, and it should show y'all, how pervasive its influence and its, like deep resonance with a liberal white feminist and white supremacy. It is, however many years later, 30 something years later. So for a terrible book and like a pretty shitty movie, that's something.
Yeah. It's funny. And by it's funny, I mean, it's not, it's sad and makes me yell. How much white ladies love stories about how great and strong white ladies are in the face of Islam and Muslim men, but like also just in general, like American white ladies.
Yeah, it's garbage.
Fuck yeah, is a really tenacious narrative.
All right, do better, fellow white ladies, because that was primary sources.
Primary sources. Story, story, story time. it's like Will Smith, except that it's not because of my being extremely white.
All right, nerds. I've been alluding to this all episode, but we're drawing here on Megan's research from her literally just released book, Abusing Religion. I want to be very clear that I am the author of this script today. So even the bits that Megan said, I wrote out with some edits. I made this episode happen. It's my turn to pick the Storytime primary text. And I am picking an excerpt from Megan's brand new book, Abusing Religion, because I think y'all should read it. And also because I think truly the work she's doing in it around abuse, sexual abuse in specific, race, racialization, and nationalism and gender is crucial. I'm going to keep the quote really short, and I'm going to skip over a lot of the key theoretical contributions since, like, we have the author right here to tell us a little something about what she means. So, Goodwin writes, quote, "Abusing Religion demonstrates that the stories we tell ourselves about American religious outsiders matter. These stories do real work in the world, creating and limiting conditions of possibility for religious and sexual difference in the contemporary United States and shaping presumably secular institutions." End quote. All right, lady, brand new book out in the flesh. Tell me, what should we take from this quote in particular, but then also, how does Not Without My Daughter play into the whole of what you're arguing?
Okay, I'm not allowed to use any new keywords here, so I'll try to keep it super 101 with y'all. I am showing you all that popular culture that we might be tempted to push aside shapes the world that we live in ways that we might not even pay attention to, because here's the thing. Betty Mahmoudi, not a religious studies scholar. Not Without My Daughter offers a theory of religion. And her theory of religion, which is the theory of religion shared by a lot of white ladies and a lot of other folks in the United States, is that America equals not Islam, and Islam equals not America. There's an assumption that, A, religion in the United States looks a certain way. It looks like Betty Mahmoudi. It does not look like her husband. And there's an assumption that religious freedom can and should only go so far, right? So it is not a book that explicitly says Muslims shouldn't be allowed in the United States, but it says it implicitly pretty clearly, and it has helped reinforce generations now of readers thinking that American religion excludes Islam, excludes religious difference, that folks who do religion in ways that are different than mainstream Christianity are not just weirdos, they're dangerous. And we are right to try to control them or to exclude them. Not because we hate religious freedom, obviously not. We're Americans, we love freedom. America plus freedom equals BFF. But because if we let them get too free, they take advantage of us. And we know that because look what happens. So we tell ourselves these stories about American religious outsiders being sexual predators. And we blame sex abuse, domestic violence here too, on religion. Instead of looking at a bigger picture and saying, wow, people are really shitty to each other and sexual abuse happens everywhere. It's a way for us to blame the way that humans abuse other humans on religion. And by doing that, both say that abuse is not our problem to fix, and that we're right to exclude people who do religion differently than we think it should be done. Plus, those definitions don't just happen in places that are explicitly religious, right? Like, Betty Mahmoudi mentions the fact that she's Methodist like one time. She's not speaking on behalf of Christians. She's speaking on behalf of Americans. This is a secular book that gets sold in secular bookstores that got technically secular laws passed in the technically secular fucking U.S. Senate, right? So it brings us back to that, even spaces you think are not shaped by religion, surprise, they are shaped by religion.
Yeah. So thank you.
You're welcome.
I think what I want to add, having read like every version of this book from dissertation to book, is that, and why I pulled this quote, honestly, is that you're doing this really interesting work of saying that definitions of religion, and religion is defined in places that we want to ignore, mm-hmm. that we want to say are like beneath us as a scholarly community, and then also are beneath us as like people who just live in the mm-hmm. world, right? Like to give Mahmoudi the power to define Islam, it like hurts my ears mm-hmm. to have you say that. And yet,
sorry, girl.
It's hard not to at least assent to the fact that she has had more power in delineating what Islam is in like legal contexts than like any imam I can think of. So like not a theologian nor a scholar, and yet, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And I think the other thing that you're doing so beautifully in Abusing Religion, available now, dear nerds, is that you really are taking to task the ways in which white Protestantism gets labeled neutral, mm-hmm. and therefore any abuse, any sexual abuse in particular, but any abuse that happens in those communities is like nobody's fault. Mm-hmm. Whereas in any other community, it is a collective punishment. Yes. All Muslims are violent. All LDS church members are like lascivious in a very particular way. And all pagans, witches are demonic and possessed and doing sex wrong in ways that are abusive to children. Mm-hmm. Right? Like you're doing a really great job of showing how when an American mainstream portrays religious others as inherently wrong religiously, that they are also doing sex wrong. Yep. And it makes Protestants like free to do whatever they want and who never look in the mirror around, say, cultures of sex abuse that are coded in Protestant ways.
Yeah.
So I think everyone should read this book. I learned a lot, and I don't care at all about America. So I whispered that into the mic as if it's not just like coming in at level. But anyway, thank you for sharing that.
You are welcome. I want to, yes. Couple things. One, FLDS is Mormon Fundamentalists, not the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. But yes. But also, yeah, just kind of bring us back to our thesis. This pop culture matters because it truly and materially shapes the way that, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say millions of Americans think about Islam now, but it also does it in a way that's so sneaky because these kinds of books aren't supposed to matter, because we're told that we shouldn't take them seriously, that it keeps getting to do this really gross, religiously intolerant anti-Muslim work, or anti-Mormon fundamentalist, or anti any sort of religious difference work. And that's why we want you, we need you to pay attention to where we tell ourselves stories about religion and then tell ourselves that it doesn't matter if they're a little racist or they're a little sexist or whatever, because, you know, it's just for funsies.
Right. Yeah.
Summer.
Well, I guess that's that.
Yeah, my book's a stone cold bummer, but I feel like you should read it anyway.
It is, but it's super smart.
Hey, thanks.
Shall we move on?
Before we head outside, don't forget, nerds, you've still got homework.
We know, it's summer, but there's so much good work on religion and pop culture, and we've barely scratched the surface. Here is some stuff to keep you occupied. And as always, don't forget that everything we list just now and everything we listed before will be in the show notes plus more. Megan, since this is your actual, literal field of expertise, I want to know what you recommend, but also remind you that you needn't suggest the whole 80 pages of bibliography I know you have at the ready. So with that caveat, what do you recommend?
How dare. How very dare. Me? Cite things? What? Okay, fine. So I did a kind of overview of the case studies in the book for The Revealer, which is NYU's Religion and Media Center's religion magazine. So those are available online. You can check those out and see if you want to read the rest of the book. I think you should. I think it's good. Also, if we're thinking about Islam and Muslims and American Islam and domestic violence, I want to direct you to Juliana Hammer's work. She has really shaped my thinking about abuse and religious difference, but particularly the ways that our assumptions about Islam and Muslim men harm Muslim women, even while we are trying to, quote unquote, save them. And then, since it's summer, I want you to go read or watch or take in literally any creative work made by a Muslim woman who didn't escape from anything. Or, if you want pop culture work specifically about Iranianness and gender, you can check out A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, which is an Iranian Western vampire film I have also written about.
Rad. I'm gonna stick to pop culture and Islam. And quite honestly, a lot of the academic books that I was going to recommend, we've recommended above this. Mm. So I'll put those in the show notes and skip them here. But let's talk pop culture and Islam, since that's kind of the theme of this episode, and it's definitely what I know best. I think friend of the pod, Michael Muhammad Knight, will definitely eye roll at us and maybe get like,
mad
very
at
baby.
Us.
Like, please do not body slam. What's a wrestling move? Don't do a body slam at me.
I don't actually know anything about wrestling.
Me neither. But his book and its film adaptation, Taquicor, is another pop culture moment and movement. The book literally inspired a movement of punk Islam and punk Muslims. So it's a little bit pulp too, I think I'd suggest. I think he'd say the same. But please, y'all, he's our friend and he's so much more than this movement in his life. So go read his other books. Megan in particular always recommends Blue-Eyed Devil. I really like Why I'm a 5%er.
Yeah.
And he's got a brand new book out with UNC.
Yes, a scholarly monograph.
A scholarly monograph coming at you real soon. Mm-hmm. I'll put all of those things in the show notes. If you want something to like Netflix and chill with, you've got Raimi on Hulu. It's not a perfect show, but I do think it's doing some real work to be honest about his own experience. And I'll post up some critique about it too, largely from Muslim women. We wrote a thing about RuPaul's Drag Race and Persian princess Jackie Cox. That's pop culture and racialization. Mm-hmm. And Salam Khanom Jackie Cox June. And of course, the major homework of this episode is Megan's brand new, like out 3 days ago, book, Abusing Religion, Literary Persecution, Sex Scandals, and American Minority Religions with Rutgers University Press. That is officially all we've got for today. But wait a minute. That's actually all we've got for Smart Girl Summer. We hope that these four thematic episodes have been a break from COVID isolation, a reminder to be anti-racist in the midst of national protests, and frankly, like state-sanctioned extrajudicial murder.
Yeah.
A splash of something bubbly while you take a walk to take a break from all of that stuff. Season 2 is next, and we're going to get your syllabus up online in short order. Until then, nerds.
You can find Megan, that's me, on Twitter at MPGPhD, and Elise at PROFIRMF, or the show at keepingit_101. Find the website at keepingit101.com. com.
Peace out, nerds.
Do your homework. It's on the syllabus. And make your beach read about something other than white ladies who need rescuing. I see you, Karens. I see you.
You would think as an Iranian-American actor, I should be able to play any part, good, bad, what have you. But a lot of times in Hollywood, when casting directors find out you're of Middle Eastern descent, they go, oh, you're Iranian, great. Can you say, I will kill you in the name of Allah? I go, I could say that, but what if I were to say, hello, I'm your doctor? They go, great, and then you hijack the hospital. Like, I think you're missing the point here.